The following lecture was given to introduce the teachings on the monadic journey and the constitution of the human microcosmic soul and the human microcosm. And it contains some important information that is basic to understanding the further and more complex information that comes. So I offer it here.
In his famous short novel, Christmas Carol, Charles Dickens pretty much sums up the great wisdom that comes through many different traditions. He certainly sums up in a couple of sentences the sum and substance of the secret doctrine and Vedic teachings and most mystical teachings of different great exalted religions through the mouth of Marley's ghost, who speaks to Scrooge. And he says, "Ages of incessant labor by immortal creatures for this earth must pass into eternity before the good of which it is susceptible is all developed." There is a very long path, as we all know, that all things are on and all reality moves through, all that manifests in form in time. And we human beings have spent much time trying to make meaning out of this life. It's not simple to understand. Questions are, if there is a God, how can there be evil in the world, and all these other philosophical questions that are not just asked by philosophers, they're asked by regular people all the time, and each of us, and so on. But one thing we can be certain is that the meaning of life is very much an individual matter, because what things mean and how we interpret them and how we understand depends very much upon who we are, what we're doing, what our attitude is, and what we're looking for, and so on. But when I'm going to talk about meaning in life, I'm going to talk about the higher, more expanded, more profound meaningfulness of life. And I'm going to give us seven basic postulates. All science begins with postulates. In the American Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson postulated from that which had been agreed upon by Rousseau and Locke and Thomas Paine and many other writers about the new kinds of ideas about human beings and government that were emerging, that that according to Jefferson, he and the people he was with accepted these basic ideas or definitions or concepts. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all people are created equal, meaning with equal rights, not with equal talents or anything, or opportunities. And that among these rights are the right to life, to liberty, the pursuit of happiness, and many others not specified. And it's with this kind of postulation that the form of government and the whole style of American life and politics was preceded at that time. We use postulates for anything, any form of science that we want to carry on. We have to start examining what the postulates of it are, and we want to see what have we really postulated, whether it's plain geometry or anything else. And so I'm going to kind of clarify what I feel are seven basic postulates about the meaning of life and existence, especially human life, because this teaching cycle is about the human soul. What we in the West call a human soul, it's called other things in other traditions, basically about the meaning of human spiritual life. The first postulate I'll put forth is that meaning is found in relationship to others, not in mere isolation of the self. None of us has any identity without community. None of us has any reality without our context. We cannot be taken singly. The planet dissolved, other humanity dissolved, other human beings dissolved, and one of us exists. We wouldn't be able to survive even existentially without that for a second. We exist as part of a greater whole. And achievement and joy and harmony and growth, evolutionary growth, all are in relation to others and to what I'll call the divine other, which is the other that we never quite succeed in getting to as we begin to identify ourselves with others. So I postulate that meaning, first of all, is found in relationship to others, not simply in isolation of one's own self. That, I think, is demonstrable in many ways, but I won't try to prove a postulate. The second thing I would say is that the meaningfulness of our incarnate activity, of the things that we do, we incarnate beings do, comes through progressive, intentional, and sacrificial work that is done on what we call the upward path, what the Greeks call the anados, or the evolutionary arc. It's progressive because it increases understanding, it results in growth of all kinds of things, expansion of vision, of service, of identity with higher self, higher ego. It's intentional because it's chosen by the free exercise of will, not because it's compulsive. And it's sacrificial because it is done for the benefit of all, not for the isolated self. And it is work because that's the definition of meaningful activity I'm going to use. Meaningful activity, work, can be what we do here at this table. It can be done in the context of whatever our daily work is. And that we're going to define also as priesthood. The third postulate is that the meaning of self or identity is we, is plural. Since we cannot make sense of ourselves out of the context of humanity and community that we exist in our environment, it follows that our identity is not only inextricably tied to the community of humanity, the community of sentient beings, but that our very identity itself, our true identity, is we, is part of many other, of a much larger form of consciousness. And that within that community are all sorts and conditions of beings, and at the top of that community and guiding it and overseeing it and parenting it and shepherding it are those beings that have responsibility for us as we have for our own children. We call them hierarchy, the elders of humanity. Again, when the ghost of Marley is speaking to Scrooge, this conversation ensues. Dickens was a brilliant spiritual teacher. A very interesting person, too. All of his characters he first met in dreams. People would sometimes see him at the breakfast table having conversations with these characters. They were very live to him. He was very involved in this sort of work. Scrooge says to the ghost of Marley, "But you were always a good man of business, Jacob." And the ghost wrings his hands and cries, "Business!" He says, "Mankind was my business. The common welfare was my business. Charity, mercy, forbearance, and benevolence were all my business. The dealings of my trade were but a drop of water in the comprehensive ocean of my business." And Dickens means for us to understand that the real business, the real reason we're here is because of these things: common welfare, mankind, charity, mercy, forbearance, and so on. In other words, it's not what we do, it's how we do it. And so therefore we have to very emphatically reaffirm that the end never justifies the means. Only the means can justify the ends, especially in spiritual terms. And so Mr. Scrooge, who was a good man of business, and when someone owed him money, and if he didn't pay it by a certain date, he would have to go to the debtor's prison or whatever, Mr. Scrooge said, well, let him go. That's his karma. That's what he needs to do, and so on. There was no room for charity or mercy or forbearance in Mr. Scrooge's life. But as a matter of fact, as Mr. Marley's ghost was telling him, he had made a terrible mistake. That in fact, the real value, the real purpose, and the real meaning in life was in fact, how he dealt with other people and what he did. So the meaning of self or of identity is we. A fourth postulate is a little more complex, but I think anyone who's spent time looking at what we call reality, or what it is, whatever it is that is the object of our perceptions, whether as a scientist or as a philosopher, would agree that this postulate is fairly accurate. That most of reality is invisible and imperceptible to human senses. Most of what's out there, so to speak, is invisible and imperceptible to us. It must be, or can be, or perhaps can be, or seems to be able to be, gradually unveiled through the expansion of perception, and through accurate interpretation of evidence and clues, and through careful synthetical discrimination of authentic teachings and conclusions from others who have sought reality, philosophers and whatever. But most of it is invisible and imperceptible, and that the way to finding it involves intelligence and perseverance and carefully discriminating wisdom that has come from many channels and so on. And again, I would postulate that as a kind of a corollary to this, that a human being is the most complex and developed of all incarnate lives, and yet the greater part of human reality is invisible and imperceptible to human senses. Jesus said, "Ye are all gods," quoting from the psalmist. Mother Jenny, my teacher, said, "Ye are the greatest mystery." The human mystery is the greatest mystery. The Master Paul said, "Know ye not that ye shall judge the angels?" Human beings are, in terms of what we might say in terms of transcendental relationship to their origins and to the divine other, to God, perhaps the most separated of all beings. And the psalmist says that thou hast created man a little lower than the angels. And yet, in order to be projected out that far into the nethermost planes and regions of reality, the human being has something that makes it more powerful than any other kind of emanation, any other kind of divine emanation. That it has the power to go out to the nethermost regions of chaos and to transform it and to return. And therefore, the human being is, in Buddhist terms, the most desirable incarnation to have. It's more desirable to be a human being than it is to be a god. It is more desirable to be a human being than it is to be an angel. The angels can never experience this reality and cannot undergo transformation other than the basic transformation of the fallen angels and so on. So a human being is indeed the most complex and developed of all incarnate lives, yet the least able to understand its own condition. Another postulate I put this way. When I say I've got to get over the idea that I have a soul. Because the truth is, the soul has me. You don't have a soul. A soul has you. It's important to recognize that the incarnate self that you are, that the self that each of us recognizes as I, is an externalization or kind of a holographic imprinting of a greater reality on matter, that this incarnate self that thinks itself to be I is in fact not the true self that you are or that I am. We in fact, if we were to contemplate our true self or through its many octaves, it would be as though the reflection of a face in a mirror were contemplating the face. And the interesting thing about a mirror image is that it's an inverse function. It's not just backwards. It's an inverse function. A mirror image has a left hand for a right hand, and a right hand for a left hand, and a left eye for a right eye, and so on. From the way that as the hands, for example, fit together, like this. And for that reason, we have an inverse view of our relationship to what we see as our image. But the soul is not the image of us. We are the image of the soul. We are what the soul is, or what the higher being is reflected in matter, and we are as real compared to that as a reflection or reflected image is to the actual object. It's the real face in the mirror that originates the motion, and it is the reflected face that simply mimics it or follows it. Jesus said, "Wretched is the body that depends upon another body, and wretched is the soul that depends upon these two." The body depends upon the soul. The body is an externalization of the soul. The body is a very imperfect extension of the soul. When the soul withdraws, so to speak, from flesh and from matter, the matter loses all of its integrity and its wholeness. And if the soul would withdraw from me, I would fall to the earth. I would no longer be, that wouldn't be me. I would be gone. I would have withdrawn. And my body would fall to the earth and immediately would start going through processes that are decay and that are decomposing processes. Because it is the soul that holds the body together in form, that gives it the processes that allow it to add to itself and grow and hold itself in form. And when the soul withdraws from the flesh, the body falls to the earth like a cast-off garment and begins to decay. And so the reflection is dependent upon the true object that is reflected. And we have to get used to a very strange idea that I, who call myself I, who think and who have a name, this is not my true identity. I am actually simply a separated image of my true identity. And in order to make the connection between what I perceive of as me and who and what I really am is a veil or a series of veils that has to be lifted, and it is a finally achieve a continuity of that consciousness and finally to achieve a unity of that where, so to speak, the soul acts through me and my personality in a very definite kind of way, is a great achievement. In the Agni Yoga teachings, it's said that the first 7 years of a person's life, that the soul is continues to incarnate in the body. The incarnation doesn't just happen all at once in the seed in the womb or whatever. That the soul continues to try to incarnate, and the process of the continuity of this incarnation is first on a physical level, that at first the soul tries to gain control of the physical body and so on. And it is said that in the first 7 years of life, that is the main process that's going on. The soul is gaining control of the body. And then in the second series of 7 years, and the third series of 7 years, and so on, different processes are happening. In the second series of 7 years, the other vehicles of the body, finer vehicles, are being developed, and the glands are formed and begin to activate. It's through the glands that the next sequence, in ages 14 to about 21, where finally the notochord dissolves from the spine and certain kinds of fiery energies are activated, and so on. And it's said in the teachings of Agni Yoga that it is not until a person is about 28 years old that he really has all of his parts working. And one is also, a normal person is in the process of recapitulating karma and previous incarnations and so on during much of his life. And it's only when a person reaches about the age of 40 or 42 that person is actually in a position to truly show forth and to image forth what there is within him or her. So that it may be that a very young and beautiful woman could be really very full of lots of darkness inside. You could see a very beautiful and young face, 18, 19, 20, And the beauty, the external beauty, has no relationship to what's going on internally in that person. But when you get to see, when people get to be in their 40s or early 40s, then you start to be able to see written in the face and in the posture and everything else about those people. You begin to see what really, the quality of their fire, what really is there. And that is when the soul is fully incarnate as it's going to be. Finally, the final postulate is that we enter life and we suffer various conditions and we exit life according to discernible natural laws. If you step off the porch, you'll fall down and hurt yourself, but without easily discernible moral or spiritual meanings. In other words, it's very easy to describe physical laws. It's very easy to describe certain natural causes and effects that exist in the world. And we come into life and we suffer various conditions and we exit life according to these things. Basically, it's our ignorance that hurts us in this way, because the more we understand about nature and environment and things like this, the better we can live with it. But at the same time, these laws, which can be learned, are different than the laws that govern us in our development. There are not easily discernible, evident moral or spiritual meanings in life. There's the simple reward for virtue, for example, in life. The good die young very often, and things like this. These aren't able to be related. That there are no moral or spiritual meanings to life is rather easily proven wrong, because we find many examples that where people have bad moral or spiritual habits and lead them into a personal suffering condition. We know there must be some kind of moral or spiritual meanings in life. So it is a bad conclusion to simply say that there are none, and that's why we don't see any. But simple-minded spiritual meanings are also inadequate. The kinds of things that fundamentalist religions provide, those can also be shown to simply be not cover reality as it really is. And so we would have to conclude then that this profound and hidden spiritual meaning must exist in life, but it's part of a greater reality that has to be carefully sought out. It's not simple. There are no simple solutions to this. In other words, it's a science. It's a deep study. And it isn't something that 14-year-olds can understand, and it isn't something that we can write simple little formulas for. I hear the story of the astronomer and the clergyman who sat together on the airplane. And the astronomer said to the clergyman, "You know, I've studied a little about lots of religions and things like this, and I've come to the conclusion that really the basic statement that can be made about religion and spirituality can be summed up with the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have others do unto you." Well, the clergyman thought for a while. He thought that was a nice statement. And he said, "Well, I've made a study of astronomy, too. And I've come to the conclusion that the sum and substance of astronomy can be basically discerned in this little saying, 'Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are.'" And I think that the two are interesting because there is a great science of spirituality and of what it means to be human and whether we have come and whence we go and so on. You know, this inverse relationship between the image and the reflection, between the reflection and the reality, is very interesting because when you go away from it, it goes away from you, and when you come draw near to it, it draws near to you, which, as we know, is a divine characteristic. We say, as we turn to God, God comes running to us, and so on. Jesus made an interesting statement to the Pharisees of the time. He said that that all sin would be, and all blasphemy and all sin would be forgiven, but there was one sin that was, and his word was, it's translated in the King James as an eternal sin, as an aeonic sin, an olamic sin. And that is a sin he called the sin against the Holy Spirit. And what is this thing? Well, it's not because there's one thing you can do that's so bad that you'd just be in trouble forever. The sin against the Holy Spirit, so to speak, is a condition where one adopts an attitude that makes it impossible for that person to achieve any kind of enlightenment. It can be compared to turning your back to the sun and you always look in a shadow. And until one is willing to turn around, one doesn't see the light. One will always be doomed to look in the shadow. The terms eternal and forever and ever and so on, as used in the teachings of Jesus, are very poorly understood. They do not refer to lengths of time. They refer to states of consciousness in the Aramaic. And that's a subject of another lecture. But there is no such thing in the teachings, any of the teachings of anyone, any great teachers, of forever and ever damnation or forever and ever anything. And that doesn't exist in the Christian teachings, only in the church teachings. So life's meaning can be contained in three keys that I like to sum up. And they are the keys to the directions that the temple and the Templar define themselves in this kind of way, in terms of purity and fidelity and collegiality. Purity is the work with the self. Fidelity is the work with others, and including the higher and the expanded self and the divine other. And collegiality, or community, is a synthetical work that creates meaning and progress in the context of the all, in the context of everything we are. And these are three basic kinds of keys to the work that we do in the temple.